KaiserNetwork.org.
Everyone, and welcome to today's Kaiser Conversation on Health. I'm Matt James, Senior Vice President for Media and Public Education at the Kaiser Family Foundation. And the Kaiser Conversation on Health is an event that we started to try to bring health policy newsmakers to Washington here in the Barbara Jordan Conference Center in the Kaiser Family Foundation building in Washington to explain what they're working on and the issues that they're concerned with. This is our latest in a Kaiser Conversation on Health series. It is also broadcast live on KaiserNetwork.org. Past guests have included Virginia Governor Mark Warner, CMS Administrator Mark McClellan, Aetna CEO Jack Rowe, former HHS Secretary Tommy Thompson, and Irish activist and sometimes musician Bono. Today's guest is Stanley Terrell, who is the CEO and chairman of Eli Lilly Company. Now, before we get into a heavy-duty policy discussion, let me tell you a little bit about Mr. Terrell. First, it's important for you to know that he has held just about every job I think you can hold at Eli Lilly at one time or another. He began there in 1971, right out of Columbia Business School, and worked his way steadily up the ladder until he became the CEO and chairman in 1999. Now, that's the public history that some of you may know. Now, let me tell you just a little bit more about Mr. Terrell that you may not know. First of all, he was born in one of the great cities in the world, Casablanca. He has lived virtually all over the world. As a profile in pharmaceutical executive mentioned, they wrote, he speaks French, English, Portuguese, and Spanish. He married a native of Brazil. Terrell proposed to his wife in Heidelberg, Germany. They became officially engaged in Casablanca. They legalized their union in a civil ceremony in Columbus, Ohio, and they took part in a religious ceremony in Paris, France. Terrell noted, home has always been wherever I'm living at the moment. Now, just to stick with the international theme for just a moment, he has taken his international flavor and brought a lot of that to Indiana. He has established the International School of Indiana, which emphasizes language immersion, and he has three kids who were born in three different countries. The best I could do was have one child born in a red state and one in a blue state. Stanley Terrell is our only guest, or at least I thought this. I got to apologize. I thought he was our only guest, who is a Chevalier of the French Legion of Honor, which is in effect being knighted. But then I did a little bit of checking, and I'm sorry to say that Bono also has that honor. But that's not bad company to be in. So in just a moment, I'm going to turn this over to Jackie Judd, our Vice President, who is going to ask questions of Mr. Terrell and about what he has been working on. But just a reminder, again, for those who are watching this on KaiserNetwork.org, if you have a question and you'd like to have it read to Mr. Terrell, you can email that question to conversations@kff.org. That's conversations@kff.org. Let me add one more last housekeeping item, if you will. Our next Kaiser Conversation on Health is going to be on June 13th, and we're going to, at that day, have Kenneth Cole come in and talk about AIDS activism and celebrity activism in this 25th anniversary of the HIV-AIDS epidemic. Now, let me also offer just one last offer, if you will, to Mr. Terrell. One of the things we noticed when we were doing our research also is Eli Lilly Company has been sort of a breeding ground for public servants and politicians. So as some of you know, Randall Tobias became our AIDS coordinator and is now looking at running USAID. Mitch Daniels, of course, is now the governor of Indiana. So if you want to use the vast resources of Kaiser Network and make any major political announcements, we offer the stage to you. And with that, I'll turn it to Jackie.
Welcome.
The deadline for enrolling in Part D without financial assistance is fast approaching. How is it affecting you?
Well, first of all, I think the Medicare drug benefit is a great addition to the Medicare program. I think the enrollment has been going well, according to the figures that the CMS has been releasing. About more than 30 million, maybe 31 million people have enrolled, and there are another 6 million or so who have another form of coverage. That's out of a total of 42 million. Where we are affected is in terms of the sales and therefore the pricing. And as has been published by CMS, the average discount that CMS has obtained from manufacturers has been 27% versus an estimate last year of 15%. So that the free market, if you will, is working. In terms of the effect on us, we are getting access to these plans more or less at the same level as we do in the private sector. I think that there might be some slight benefit initially in terms of volume. We haven't seen that yet. It's too early. But there may be, because there are some people who simply did not have access and have access now to drug coverage. But over time, I expect that the impact will be one of very tough pricing negotiation over time. And of course, there is always the risk of government price control at some point in time.
As you say, it is early. And I know the original expectations were for a sales bump of about 2 to 3% in what you were selling. Does that feel about right?
We've never quantified really what the impact would be, because there were some countervailing aspects here. For some products, probably lower price because of the negotiating power of the health plans. For other products, a bit of an increase in volume. But some products, like our biggest product, Zyprexa, is not really affected in volume too much, because a great part of our market is the is Medicaid patients and dual eligibles, and those already had coverage.
You talk about the price pressure. Some analysts say that in the next 2 to 3 years, that price pressure will become even greater as drug plans look at what's being charged and decide to drop certain drugs from their lists. Mm-hmm. How do you anticipate something like that? What do you do to prepare? Mm-hmm.
Well, fortunately, some of our drugs, the key products, are among the six categories that CMS has designated as needing to have essentially all products available on the formulary, because people react differently to those drugs. For example, antipsychotics, like our Zyprexa, which is the number one product, antidepressants. This applies also to anti-cancer drugs, to, I think, HIV drugs, I think, asthma compound, and one other category. So for those, both for 06 and 07, CMS has basically determined that health plans could not just eliminate some products from a formulary.
But beyond 2007, it's an
open.
Unknown.
It's an unknown, absolutely. And for other therapeutic areas, clearly, we have companies have to compete the way we compete in the private sector, which is to demonstrate that you have a better cost-benefit ratio than your competitors.
Lilly and many other companies, drug companies, had patient assistance programs for people unable to afford to buy the drugs. Part D put those programs pretty much in a state of flux. And I understand that Lilly now, in a limited way, wants to reinstitute a part of the program for the duration. Fill us in on that.
Okay, let me explain that. We have several different patient assistance programs, some that we've had for a very long time. In total, the value of those programs went from $150 million in 2001 to $425 million in 2005. That's 5% of the total Lilly sales. About half of that is for low-income patients, period. Mm-hmm. That's called Lilly Cares. Then in 2002, we introduced Lilly Answers, which was meant to be a bridge towards the Medicare drug benefit for Medicare-eligible patients, elderly and disabled. This program was terminated the enrollment at the end of 2005 as patients were enrolling into Medicare. What we have found is that for some products, particularly the more expensive products or those for whom continuity of care is very important, such as antipsychotic, even with a drug benefit, low-income people who did not qualify for the low-income subsidy, in other words, people above 135% of the federal poverty level, were still going to have difficulty paying for the drug. So we are doing three things right now, which we are announcing today. One is that we will continue the overall program for all products until the end of the year for people who are not enrolled in Medicare yet. And we will encourage those people to enroll in Medicare. Two, we will, for our two key products for which there is a problem of access, for TEO, for osteoporosis, and Zyprexa, for schizophrenia and bipolar disease, offer a bridge program for Medicare, for people enrolled in Medicare, And we have we want to make sure that people don't use this towards the true out-of-pocket calculation, so that this would be consistent with the overall guidance that the OIG has given. And at the same time, we're asking the Inspector General for specific approval of our plan, which we would hope then would continue over time.
And so the two drugs you selected, you did that because of the cost?
Yes.
The cost barriers?
And the importance of continuing the treatment for those patients, because if you are on an antipsychotic and you go to another one, you can have a tremendous relapse.
If somebody is paying full freight for Forteo, several hundred dollars a month, I understand?
Yes.
$600, $650 a month?
Yeah, I don't know the exact number, but that's when I look at last year's Lilly Answers program, Forteo represented almost half of the total. I mentioned about $200 million for Lilly Answers, and Forteo was 90+ of that. So the two products that we have selected are really the bulk of what has been the Lilly Answers program so far.
And so how many people do you think will be able to take advantage of it if the Inspector General says okay?
I don't have that calculation. I know that the Lilly Answers program has covered, I believe, 210,000 patients last year, but a large majority of those are now enrolled in Medicare, and a portion of those are above the 200% of federal poverty level, which is a criterion to be eligible for the patient assistance program.
I know the question for a lot of people in our audience here and on the web as well, because we've received emails already, is why are the drugs so expensive?
Well, that's a large question, obviously. First, it takes 12 to 15 years to bring a drug from the twinkle in a researcher's eye all the way to a patient. This is a risky and expensive and lengthy proposition. I'm sure you've seen some of the studies which have been done over time showing that on average a drug costs about $800+ million. Those are the published studies. I think if you look at the reality inside the labs, it's actually the figures are actually higher than that. That cost covers obviously the risk. In other words, it covers all of the failures as well as the time value of money, because it takes 12 to 15 years. So that's the big reason. And so today's prices and profits of pharmaceutical companies help pay for the research that we are doing to cover unmet medical needs. This being said, I think the current model as it exists is probably not sustainable. So we are all about doing two things. One is reduce our cost base and try everything we can throughout the value chain to reduce the cost of bringing drugs to market in the current, what I would call, one-size-fits-all model. And secondly, we are at the same time exploring a new model of more tailored therapies. And let me explain that a little bit. Today the value proposition that we have for patients, for payers, and for providers is not an optimal value proposition, because we test products for a given disease, and then we go to a provider and say, try it on your patients with that disease. And in the best cases, it's going to work on 8 patients out of 10. In the worst cases, it may work on 1 out of 10 or 2 out of 10. And it may hurt 1 out of 100 or 1 out of 1,000. Today, we are not really able to precisely tell providers, use it on this patient, not on that patient. It may hurt this one. But science is moving progressively in that direction, with new technologies like biomarkers, pharmacogenomics, bioimaging, and so on. We are progressively moving towards this future of more personalized medicine.
Right.
And that's the sort of challenge for the pharmaceutical industry, and what we are really all about in our strategy is to make the current model more cost-effective, and at the same time make the investments in technologies necessary to move into this new model.
How does that model affect the cost? Does it affect the actual R&D cost? Does the $800 million-plus figure go down in that scenario?
Time will tell. Initially, probably not, but over time, we hope that it will, because biomarkers and pharmacogenomics will help us target better the patients who will participate in clinical trials. So instead of having a shotgun approach, as we do today, have a large population of patients with a given disease, we will test it on much less, smaller population. We might also have more products that way, because today we kill very early some molecules if we find that there is a problem. But if we, through pharmacogenomics, can identify a subset of the population which, for whom that problem doesn't exist, then the product would be allowed to continue in development. At the other end, on the sales side, you might argue that this will be smaller molecules in terms of sales. How the economic model will work out, nobody can tell you today, but this is the direction in which we're working.
And it's a very, very long-range plan.
Yes.
I think the people who today ask the question, why are they so expensive, mm-hmm. want some more immediate help. And for some, the second part of that question is usually this. Why shouldn't the government begin to set prices, to negotiate prices, particularly now, since it's become a much larger purchaser than ever before?
Well, as Matt said, I have lived in several countries around the world, and many of them have price controls and government price controls. And what we have seen has been that over time, this kills the incentives for innovation. And when you look at the amount of R&D which was done in Europe 30 years ago versus today, Europe went from something like 60% of the R&D for pharmaceuticals and the new products to something like 25% today. So 30 years of price controls have really caused a lot of the R&D and the new products to move to the United States, which has a freer market. On the other hand, they don't necessarily save a lot on their drug bill, because the price controls applies also to products once they are off patent. In this country, and we were discussing this just before we came in, once a patent expires, the inflow of generic competitors brings the prices down extremely quickly. In countries with price controls, not so. They may have a price approved by the government at 20 or 30% below the original price. So the prices of generic products and off-patent products are much higher outside of the U.S. than they are in the U.S. The system that we have really forces us to stay on our feet and ensure that, once a patent expires for a product, we have something else to replace it and hopefully more innovation.
I suspect the audience will have some follow-up questions on that point, so I won't pursue it here. But I do want to ask this question. The pricing issue has made so many people in America so cynical about your industry. You've been in this business since 1971, as Matt said. Do you ever stand back and ask yourself, how did the pharmaceutical industry that improves lives, save lives, sometimes be talked about in the same sentence as the tobacco industry?
Of course.
How did we land there?
I ask myself that question very, very often. I think one fundamental issue is, I'd say, the difference between the psychology of want and the psychology of need. If you want something, you are prepared to pay the price for it and not argue. If you want a car and you want it convertible and you want it red, you will pay the price it takes to get that car. But the gasoline which goes into that car is something that you need but not necessarily want. And so when the price goes up, you get mad because it's imposed on you. Well, healthcare belongs in the category of things that you need and don't particularly want. And so that makes you suspicious of whoever makes a living out of healthcare and mad at companies which seem to have a high level of profitability. The solution to that over time is really to ensure better access through better insurance. And frankly, the image of the pharmaceutical industry in Europe, where there is better access, is better than the image we have in this country. This is not the whole problem. I think there are some issues of perceived business practices that needed to be addressed, and I think have been addressed. In every other industry, to take your customer to lunch is an acceptable practice. It is no longer an acceptable practice, an accepted practice in our industry. And so we have changed, as an industry, our ways of working.
And the new guidelines for advertising, direct-to-consumer advertising?
Same thing. I think the direct-to-consumer advertising is something that meets an overall societal trend of people wanting to understand better about their own health care and take their destiny in their own hands, if you will. It meets also the need to, there are many diseases for which people don't seek treatment. So if you can educate through direct-to-consumer people about the fact that this can be treated, you will get a better outcome for everyone. There is also issues of compliance with treatment, especially on diseases for which you don't have symptoms. People generally don't comply with the treatment. So direct-to-consumer communication, not just mass advertising, but other means, help people, remind people of the need to take their medicine. But I think in spite of these potential benefits of direct-to-consumer, it's been criticized because it sort of has trivialized a little bit the perception of the industry. We do not sell detergents. We sell products which save lives or prolong the lives or improve the quality of lives.
Does it frustrate you that you even need to say something like that?
Yes, of course it does. Of course it does. But so to address this second area of business practices, I think we've, in the last few years, the industry has come together to adopt codes of practice. There has been some, both for good promotional practices vis-a-vis physicians, direct-to-consumer advertising. There was criticism also of the research that we do and conflicts of interest for investigators, whether the results of studies were published or not. And we've brought a lot of transparency to this by, and Lilly was a leader in this area, by creating a registry where at the beginning of any clinical trials, it is registered in this website, which is publicly available, so that people can check once the study results are being published that indeed all the studies which were started are being published, whether the result is positive or not. So again, those are the two key areas, I think, access and business practices, and I think we're addressing both.
Before we turn it over to the audience, I want to talk to you about your vision for healthcare reform. I've heard you talk about it before. And you break it down into three interesting parts: the metabolic disorder, the autoimmune disorder, and the cognitive disorder. Explain.
Okay. Metabolic disorder. I think what we are seeing in the healthcare system is a dysfunctioning market. For a market to function, you need to have an economic signal between buyer and seller, where price is arrived at through a negotiation, and quality is known and transparent. We don't have that in the healthcare system because people don't realize the cost of what they buy. Most people get their insurance to their employer. They don't see the bills. And these are after-tax dollars. So they don't have a feel for what it costs. And that's particularly true, by the way, for pharmaceuticals, but that's besides the point. So that's the metabolic disorder. It's overconsumption because we don't realize the cost of what we consume. The second one is autoimmune. And that is the effect of all the government regulations which surely intended to protect consumers, have very often perverse consequences. For example, all the state regulations of insurance, which makes the provision of insurance a very complex and costly, more costly proposition that it needs to be, because you have to abide by 50 different state regulations. Of course, our tort system is part of this as well. And, you know, calculations have been made that the extra cost of tort is probably in the range of $90 billion a year.
And there are people, I should say, who would disagree with that. And then the final part is the cognitive.
This is basically a factor of all the information which is available out there and that we don't allow ourselves to take advantage of. We have all the tools in information technology that we need to make this system much more effective and to improve quality. And yet, it is not deployed in healthcare in the same way as it is deployed in other services, such as financial services, for example. We have our own, as consumers, our own version of a cognitive disorder by knowing what hurts us and still engaging in behaviors that do, like smoking and so on and so forth. Physicians have their own version of that by not keeping up to date with best treatments. And we should have information on the best practices that are being used everywhere, and that's not happening. So those are three symptoms, if you will, of the disease. And the disease is, you know, high cost and escalating costs, problems of quality, and problems of access.
And that's the diagnosis. What's the prescription?
Well, there are many, many ideas, obviously.
If you could pick one, what do you think would have the most significant impact on the way the healthcare system currently works?
I'm going to cheat and take two. Okay.
It's a deal.
All right. I think the first one is one where there is a very strong bipartisan support, and that is to better use information technology, to have systems which are more interoperable, to have common standards, and to eventually have, you know, on a chip, patient records that patients can carry with them, so that you can avoid all of the duplication of tests and so forth. That would have a tremendous impact, and some calculations have been made as how much could be saved through that. The other one is to address the needs of the uninsured. Besides the problem of equity, which is a serious problem, you have also an economic problem, because people who don't have access to healthcare insurance end up in the emergency room and don't have access to preventive care, which is much more cost-effective. And so we see tremendous cost shifting because when they end up in the emergency room, they are treated, and the cost ends up on somebody else's bill. There are about 45 to 48 million uninsured in this country, and they are divided in about three more or less equal groups. One is a group of people who are eligible for some kind of government program and have not enrolled. So an outreach program to make sure that those people enroll, I think, needs to be engaged in. And I think the experience that CMS, the health plans, have had with Medicare enrollment, with a lot of grassroots efforts, all of this, I'm sure, a lot of learning has occurred that can help address the needs of those people. Then you have a group of people who simply are not eligible but simply cannot afford it. And I think those people need some help of some kind.
In what form?
Well, one of the options is health savings accounts, but with a refundable tax credit for the low-income people. That would basically, if you will, a sort of voucher system that would be offered by the government. And a lot of studies show that this can be paid for by the savings that you have by getting the uninsured actually covered. And then you have another group of people who you know, can afford health insurance but don't think they need it. Very often young people, young professionals who don't feel it's worth spending money in healthcare. And there, I think we've got to experiment with some thoughts of, you know, using sticks or carrots to get people to buy some health insurance, so that you increase the pool of people who are insured, which reduces the cost for everyone. And there is a very interesting experiment going on, as you know, in Massachusetts,
right.
Which I think we need to monitor very, very carefully, which uses that sort of stick and carrot approach. I think it's a very interesting experiment. Now, not to say that it can be used throughout the country, because I think the conditions in Massachusetts are specific, But I think it's a very positive step.
Getting back to the use of health savings accounts, and right after this question, I'm going to ask you to start taking questions from the audience. One of the central criticisms of health savings accounts are that the people who can least afford the high deductibles would be given these or expected to have them in some way. How do you answer that?
I'm not following. Why?
That the people in the low-income category cannot afford the high deductibles that often come with health savings accounts.
Yeah. I think the people in the lowest income categories need help. And I would think that a means-tested subsidy would make sense.
Okay. Let's get you to the audience. I always say this, and the joke is probably old to some of you have returned, but it's our Inside the Actors Studio moment. So you come up here.
Okay.
Who would like to get the first question? Yes, this lady up here. And if you could stand, identify yourself and your affiliation, I'd appreciate it.
I'm Jill Wexler. I'm the Washington editor of Pharmaceutical Executive Magazine. You mentioned earlier the need to develop new ways of developing drugs and getting drug approvals, and certainly the Food and Drug Administration plays a central role in that. The agency has been without strong leadership for quite some time, and the prospects aren't very good. But I haven't seen the leadership in the pharmaceutical industry saying very much about this or being very visible in perhaps putting pressure on policymakers to do something about this situation. Are there more things that industry could do or should do? And is this a big concern for you?
Okay.
I would add a second part to that question. Has the lack of a permanent commissioner affected your business?
Right. Okay. I think things are changing and are improving. One of the key priorities for the FDA is the so-called Critical Path Initiative, which is geared at exactly developing the biomarkers and other technologies that we need for the development of personalized medicines and defining a regulatory path for drugs developed that way. We are also in the process, since the NIH is also very involved with their so-called roadmap initiative with the same goal. We are talking about forming a consortium, actually, between NIH, pharma, and FDA to collaborate on the development of biomarkers in a sort of pre-competitive area. Yes, the lack of a commissioner has hurt the industry in many ways. I think the FDA is in a tough position. They never get credit for the things they do right, and they get blamed when something goes wrong. And with all the debates around the withdrawal of COX-2 inhibitors or Vioxx and other like suicidality with antidepressant and other issues surrounding side effects, we've seen the agency become a little bit more susceptible to pressures. And the number of black box warnings has tripled between 2003 and 2005. And what I find needs to be changed is a basic belief in the general public that there is such a thing as risk-free drugs. A risk-free drug is a placebo. Drugs should be evaluated on the basis of benefit versus risk. And we need to find a better way, more transparent, more objective, and more standard to assess all drugs along those lines. And I believe that's one of the important things that the FDA would be doing with the new leadership.
What were you alluding to when you said that they were susceptible to pressures?
Well, the press and people in Congress jump on issues of a side effect for a given drug and forget the benefit aspect. And that has, I think, caused the FDA to be more cautious, to have those black box warnings, perhaps be a little bit more cautious in approving drugs if you look at the number of applications which don't result in a approval in the first cycle. Those have increased. And the FDA's role is, yes, to protect public health, but part of protecting public health is to ensure that innovative drugs that can help people in need get to the market on a timely basis. And there is progress to be made in that area. I'm very confident that the new commissioner is committed to the balance in this approach.
We have a question, an email question. Please comment on the emerging research on what this writer says, disease mongering, and what short and long-term consequences this may have for your industry. And I presume by disease mongering, he means the creation of disease or the creation of need where there may actually not be much.
Mm. That's a very controversial
yes,
area. And we had our own experience. We launched a product called Seraphim, which was for PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, which is an extreme form, if you will, of PMS. Women who suffer from that were helped by this product. And doctors who treat gynecologists felt that there was a need for that product. Now, this is a true disease. But since there had been no product for it before, and often women were not seeking treatment, there has been a coverage in the press that this was a disease which was invented. Take the issue of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in children. Again, there are different views in Europe and in the U.S. about, you know, is this a disease at all? How many kids are affected by that? And so what we need is better education, better standards. Again, what I was talking about earlier, we don't have sufficiently well-defined standards of care for and diagnosis and care for diseases. So I would argue that some diseases...
Does that leave an opening for what the writer calls disease mongering?
There are some diseases which are underdiagnosed and undertreated. I mean, frankly, before Prozac and the other SSRI products and other antidepressants were launched, the estimate was that only 30% or so of people in this country who had depression were actually diagnosed and treated. So it has helped, if you will, this disease to sort of come out of the closet and be accepted and people to be treated. And a lot of suicides and ruined life have been avoided thanks to these products. So we should avoid, you know, underdiagnosis and undertreatment, as we should avoid overdiagnosis and overtreatment. And I'm sure there are some cases where the person who asked the question is right, and there may have been some extra use of products.
Cell phones off, please.
Yes. John Ruckoff from the Baltimore Sun. I have a question going back to the critical path. There are a lot of different views on what sort of regulatory reforms are needed. For example, some folks go so far as to argue for dropping the efficacy requirement. I was wondering what you think would spur drug development and speed up approvals and ease patient and improve patient access.
If you talk about the critical path, and therefore this refers typically to products which are more tailored. So for those, almost by definition, as I was discussing earlier when discussing the potential costs of this research, we will be able to show efficacy in a smaller number of patients than we do today, because we are going to be able to target the population in the clinical trials of people who are the most likely to respond positively to the drug. So that's how I see the future. Now, in the current model, what I call the one-size-fits-all, I think there is also room for reducing what has been an incredible inflation over the last two decades of number of cases to approve a new drug. Part of it is FDA regulations. Part of it is overcautious attitude on the part of the industry to make sure that the drug is really approved. But this has added to the cost, and we need to address that.
Lady back here.
Helish Devi, CNBC. You touched on this in the beginning, but if you could sum up for me how Medicare Part D is going to hurt and help your business.
Okay. Repeat what I say. I think... First, it's helping patients. some people who did not have access to drugs and drug coverage will today, and this in turn will result in some increase in the overall volume for the pharmaceutical industry. On the other hand, there will be more negotiation of prices, and some people who were buying on the free market will now buy through the Medicare program, and taking advantage of the negotiations that the health plans who administer the program have engaged in. So what I see is, over time, pressure on the prices of the industry.
Yes, over here.
Hello, my name is Jan Heinrich. I'm with Health Policy R&D. I'd like to ask you about post-marketing surveillance. There have been lots of questions, as you say, as a result of the Vioxx being withdrawn. But what would you recommend be the policy so that we can more accurately monitor the response to drugs once it's more broadly distributed in the population?
Yeah, I think regulatory agencies, including the FDA and the industry, I think, do a pretty thorough job of assessing risk versus benefits of products prior to the launch and prior to the approval. But once a product is on the market, the only thing which is being monitored is the adverse events. The continuing assessment of efficacy does not occur. And as I mentioned earlier, I think you cannot divorce one from the other. It's always a question of balance. And that balance differs from product to product and very importantly, from disease to disease. Going forward, I think we need to be able to tap the incredible amount of data that is available in day-to-day usage. CMS will have a treasure trove of data on how drugs are actually working, both efficacy and side effect-wise, once in the market. Health plans like Kaiser Permanente or United Healthcare, etc., have also a lot of data that hopefully we'll find a way one day to mine so that we can continue to assess the efficacy versus safety profile of drugs. There is so much we can do before we launch a drug. You know, we find a lot of things after it's on the market, both positive and negative.
Yes, in the back there.
This is a follow-on question. I'm Deetra Henderson with the Boston Globe. You may not have heard, but last night there was an amendment that was added to a House appropriations bill that will make the FDA will give them mandatory rights to demand that drug makers do post-marketing studies. And if those post-marketing studies are not completed, the agency can begin proceedings to take a drug off the market. This was driven by a GAO report that found that two-thirds of the post-marketing studies that drug companies say that they're going to do don't get completed. I was curious, I know it's sort of off the cuff, if you have any sense of what implications that legislation may have.
Yeah, again, not having seen the particular proposal, it's hard to comment on the details. But on the principles, I believe that companies should abide by their commitments to do post-marketing trials when agreed upon with the FDA. And we've been very, very assiduous at doing this, if you look at the record of Eli Lilly. Now, as to the stick, if you will, to be used, I thought that I would think that that taking a product off the market would hurt patients in many cases, and that doesn't seem to me to be the right approach to take. But somehow to have some strong incentive for companies to abide by their commitments makes sense to me.
You're actually going up to Capitol Hill tomorrow to meet with the leaders of the Senate Finance Committee, some of them anyway, you and other of your counterparts, to talk about the patient assistance programs. What message do you intend to bring to them, and what do you think they are going to ask of you?
Well, this is in terms of what they are going to ask is pure speculation, but I think they've expressed some concern that with the adoption of the Medicare drug benefit, some of the patient assistance programs that companies were offering are being discontinued, and that leaves some patients, low-income patients, but again, above 135% of federal poverty level, with difficulty paying for some drugs that they were receiving for free before. And the reason why we could not help as an industry those patients was an OIG opinion back in November of last year saying that you could not be at the same time enrolled in a Medicare program and receive patient assistance. This has been clarified now in April by the OIG giving approval to one company's proposal to have these programs outside of Part D. In other words, they would continue to get access to that product, but could not claim either the fee that they pay for this access or the cost of the drug itself as part of their expenditures in Medicare, which would count towards the donut hole and so forth. So I believe that the discussion will be around what can be done to continue to have programs which help patients of low income. And obviously, this will have to take place within the constraints of antitrust, because we cannot discuss between pharmaceutical companies, even with senators present, specific industry, I mean, company programs.
And I know you're only announcing today the letter that went over to the OIG to ask if the two drugs can be sold. But is there any possibility that that list at some point will get longer? Just let me finish. There's an email from a lady in Detroit who works in a free clinic, and she says, for example, why has Lilly cut off all four Medicare patients from obtaining free insulin through their prescription assistance program?
Okay. First of all, we continue to have our Lilly Cares program covering insulin for low-income people. Secondly, for the Medicare enrolled people, insulin is a low-cost product, and the total amount of the copay that they would have under Medicare is actually lower than the $25 that we charge a month for access.
She said these were people who couldn't even afford to go into Part D.
Oh, who could not afford to go to Part D. Then she's wrong, because we are continuing until the end of this year coverage of our Lilly Answers program for people who have not enrolled in Part D.
Are there questions on this side that I haven't gotten to? Yes, Tiffany, here.
Hi, my name is Shahzai Najmi. I'm from the International Trade Administration. I want to sidestep to the international side and wonder if you could speak about the image of pharmaceutical companies internationally and this philosophy of need versus want. One of the things we hear a lot when we talk to foreign governments, especially in developing countries, is going to the need aspect. They sometimes ask, why can't the pharmaceutical companies provide more access by subsidizing the poor in those countries and taking the weight off of the governments? I wondered if you could address that issue and also talk a little bit more about Lilly's MDR-TB program.
Okay. First of all, I think there are some major differences in price levels between developing and developed countries. And that exposes the industry, frankly, to criticism inside this country to say, how can you subsidize these other countries? Because we do. You know, the price of many of our products in Brazil might be a third of what it is in the U.S. How can we afford to do that? Well, we have already spent the money on the R&D. It is a sunk cost. So at that point going forward, we look at this on a marginal basis, and the cost at that point is only the cost of manufacturing the drug. So we can make those drugs available at a lower cost. But obviously, if we were to do that everywhere, we could not continue to fuel our research. In terms of the MDR-TB, this is a multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis program that Eli Lilly engaged in about 3 years ago. We found that, first, this was a very serious healthcare need in a number of developing countries, and that we had two older products that were very useful in the treatment of MDR-TB, and that use was actually discovered by Dr. Farmer. So we first looked for generic companies which would want to manufacture that drug, and couldn't find any. Those two drugs were particularly difficult to manufacture. So what we eventually did was actually make investments in companies in China, South Africa, India, and Russia, In their capacity, we, with the help of Purdue University, have transferred the technology to them and trained their technicians. We have also, with the help of Harvard Medical School, made sure that the drugs were being used appropriately and monitoring the development of resistance and so forth. And the whole program is being coordinated under the aegis of the WHO, which has a goal of, I don't know, so many thousands of patients treated by 2010 for MDR-TB, and also Médecins Sans Frontières, who have been involved in that. So it's a different approach, it's very integrated, and it sort of follows the philosophy that if you want to feed a man a meal, you give him a fish. If you want to feed him for a lifetime, you teach him how to fish. So this program is something which has cost Eli Lilly maybe $70 million or so over a three-year period. But the value that it is creating by being self-perpetuating is, you know, several times that value.
Back here.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Liz Chimienti, and I'm with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. I had a question about one of the things you said in your talk regarding price controls in Europe and the fact that because of the price controls, the countries are doing or companies are doing less research in Europe. And it occurs to me that it may not be a direct effect of the price controls, so there's less money to do the research, but people... The companies actually are rewarding the U.S. by not having price controls, and so they left. And it's less of a cause and effect of Europe having the price controls but wanting to reward the U.S. So I was wondering what your opinion is of that statement. And then secondly, in terms of savings for R&D, it seems like a lot of savings could come out of the investments you're making in China and India and other developing countries that have highly skilled populations. I'm wondering if you foresee a lot more of the cutting edge R&D going abroad in the future. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, to answer the first part of your question, I would quote a study done by the U.S. Department of Commerce at the end of 2004, which looked at the effect of price differences between the U.S. and other countries, and which concluded that if Europe had the same level of prices as the U.S., we would have another $5 billion, I believe was the number, invested in R&D, and that would result in, you know, six or seven new innovative products which would benefit citizens of all the countries. And another point I would make is that the system that we have here of free pricing not only rewards innovative drugs, but also once the patent expires, the economic viability of the drug goes away immediately. Because of free competition, because of the entry of generics. So this keeps companies like mine on their toes to continuously innovate so that, you know, we can come up with the new innovation when we lose patents. And when we lost our Prozac patent, we had redoubled our efforts in R&D and had, you know, nine products that we launched over the following 3 years. The second part of your question... Yes, as I mentioned earlier, in the one-size-fits-all model, we are trying to improve our cost structure and the productivity of our R&D by looking at every aspect of the value chain. Part of it includes doing more R&D in countries like India and China, where there is a lot of talent. We have to be careful about potential intellectual property issues. So what we've done so far is to sort of separate our R&D activities between what we would call judgment-based activities and rules-based activities. And for example, today in China, we have 20% of all our chemists in the world are now in China, and they work more on the latter, on the rules-based activities. But we are exploring those models, and in India, we've been very encouraged by the fact that after the adoption of patents, last year, finally, we are seeing a lot of the generic companies trying to change their business model to a maybe low-cost, research-based model. And there are some things that perhaps we can learn and co-opt some of those through partnerships. And we've already announced a couple of those.
I just have a quick follow-up to the first half of her question, and that is, there are people who say that given the profits that the pharmaceutical industry make, innovation is not as strong as it should be, that what the focus has been on in the past several years has been the Me Too drugs.
Okay, I'm going to give you the list of the products, the 9 products that I mentioned that Eli Lilly has launched. One was Zygris, the first product ever for the treatment of severe sepsis. One was Strattera, the first non-stimulant product for ADHD. One was Alimta, which was the very first product for the treatment of mesothelioma. Another one was Cymbalta, which was the first product approved for the treatment of diabetic neuropathic pain.
I'll trust you on the other.
Okay, thank you.
Would you say that's true, the larger first product industry, which builds new bones. If you look outside of what Lilly has done, is it a fair criticism?
I don't really think so. I think there are a few examples which have been, you know, very well publicized that have may have created that impression. And also, I think innovation goes in cycles. If you look at the overall level of new products which have been approved by the FDA over the last 5 years, it was 40% less than the previous 5 years. So the cycle has been down. But if you look at a recent study by Tufts University, they are looking now at products which are in the development pipeline, and there we've seen over the last 3 years a significant uptick. So I think there is hope that there is more new innovation. One of the reasons perhaps where the productivity went down for the industry as a whole is that I think companies are actually looking more and more for breakthrough drugs, because with the current cutthroat competition that exists in the private sector and also the difficulty of getting reimbursement in the public sector, unless you have a drug which is significantly better than existing drugs or bring it to the market at a much, much lower cost, you're not going to have a success. And that's why companies are trying, you know, to really bring drugs which are better than whatever exists.
We have time for one more really quick question from the audience. Back here? Is there someone back here? Okay.
Maureen Groppi with Gannett News Service. Back on Medicare Part D. Is the pressure that Chairman Grassley and other senators put on drug companies, is that a factor in Lilly's decision to extend Lilly Answers? And is it possible that you'll extend Lilly Answers even further beyond the end of this year?
I would say no. We have been, since August of 2005, desirous to have an extension of our Lilly Answers program. And we submitted to the OIG at that time. We were the first company to submit a request for an opinion on a program which was around Part D. We have not heard back from the OIG. But since that other company got a positive approval, an approval for their program, we got some better guidelines as to what is likely to be approved and what is not. And that prompted us to immediately come up with this program. And this is separate from any political pressure.
Okay, we started with Part D and we ended with Part
That's right.
D. That was the final word. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank
your
you,
thoughts,
Jackie.
Your generosity.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. For our audience here and on the web, just another reminder that June 13th we will be having Kevin Petrenko here to talk about AIDS and the 25th anniversary. Thank you all.